thanks for joining us. I'm Diane Rehm. In an effort to resist possible new immigration deportation policies under a Trump administration, Democratic lawmakers in California are moving to enact laws that would offer immigrants legal aid. Here to talk about how cities and states are responding to immigration policies under a Trump presidency, Angela Kelly with the Center for American Progress and Stephen Camerata with the Center for Immigration Studies. Joining us from NPR in New York, Muzaffar Chishti of the Migration Policy Institute at New York University. I do invite you to offer your comments, your thoughts. Give us a call at 800-433-8850. Send an email to drshow@wamu.org. Follow us on Facebook or send us a tweet. And thank you all for joining us.
Thank you for having us.
It's good to be with you.
Thank you for having me, too.
Thank you. Steve, let me start with you. President-elect Trump has promised to deport some 3 million undocumented immigrants. During the campaign, he was talking about 11 million. What's brought about the change there in numbers?
Well, I don't think he's been entirely, very, very specific. But what he said is, look, we're going to start with the about 1.9 million people that in its own documents, the Department of Homeland Security said have committed felonies and crimes in the United States. And then he hopes to move on to others. We have, say, for example, deportation absconders, people who've been ordered deported, about 900,000, but it's not been followed up on after the judge issued those orders. After that, I think he feels that once we get enforcement in place, then we can think about other options. But for the time being, he wants to go after criminal aliens. And the other big priority that's changed is that Trump sees immigration, it seems, as a jobs issue. And he's worried about the job competition at the bottom end of the labor market, the impact on social services, and he's not so focused on the illegal immigrants themselves.
Muzaffar, I gather you and Stephen disagree on the actual numbers of undocumented immigrants who've been convicted of crimes.
That's right. I mean, we have no idea where the 3 million figure that President-elect Trump quoted in his 60 Minutes interview comes from. The best estimates we have is from a DHS study of 2012, which estimated there are about 1.9 million foreign-born people in the United States who had criminal convictions that would make them removable. And we did an analysis of those numbers, and from that we found that you could estimate that about 820,000 unauthorized people with criminal convictions are removable from the United States. So that's obviously a significant difference in the numbers. And of those, only about 300,000 have been convicted of felonies.
Where do you come out on these numbers, Angela Kelly?
Well, I think it's consistent with all of Donald Trump's policies as he shared them, which is that they're inconsistent. you don't really know from moment to moment what he's going to do. But there is a consistent theme, which is about deportation and really going after large numbers of people who are living in our communities. And we know that 2/3 of the undocumented have been here for more than a decade. Where you see a lot of resistance, and I think this is going to continue to grow, is at the state and local level, with people like college university presidents who are pushing back and saying, well, wait a minute. We know that we've got 750,000 young people who've been working legally, who are attending classes. And so you're seeing a resistance by many people across the political spectrum, red states, blue states, saying, wait a minute, let's pause this.
Muzaffar, as Angela said, you've got many mayors in cities from east to west coast saying they're not going to cooperate with federal immigration agents. What do you make of that?
Well, this has been a development which is going on for many years. As you know, for a long time we have thought that in this country that federal immigration enforcement is the exclusive province of the federal government, that states and localities have no role in that domain. After 9/11, there have been series of cooperative arrangements between federal government and states and localities which have entangled these jurisdictions in the enforcement of immigration laws. And they were obviously took a totally different leap after Secure Communities was put into place in 2008 and made universal in 2013, where almost anyone who's booked at a local jail, their fingerprints are matched against the immigration history. And then the federal government, in this case ICE, the Immigration Customs Enforcement, would ask that local jurisdiction to put a hold, what we call detainers in our parlance, to keep that person for 48 hours till ICE would come and pick them up. What these local jurisdictions found over the years, that a large number of these were people who had strong ties to the community, and they were being removed for very low-level crimes, in many cases violent, nonviolent crimes, and they started offering resistance. And so far, about 350 such jurisdictions have offered one form of resistance to the other in response to the needs of their own security in the streets.
So, Angela, where did this term, sanctuary city, come from? And what do you see happening across the country?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think it's like a piece of modern art. It means different things to different people. But I think at its core, it's about protection. And this is certainly where local law enforcement know a lot about how to protect their local communities, and Washington politicians don't. And so, as Musafir was indicating, this isn't like a new debate. We have five states, 514 counties, 38 cities that all have policies or ordinances that put limits on their local police getting entangled in enforcing federal immigration law.
So what does that mean, actually?
It means that they may hold a person, but they book a person, they take their fingerprints, and everybody's fingerprints get sent to the FBI, and that's shared with the DHS. So it's not as if DHS doesn't have an opportunity to come after and get somebody if they want to. But what they say they don't want to do is keep holding somebody who hasn't been booked, hasn't been convicted. That's where they're placing limits on saying, well, wait a minute, we can't detain people indefinitely. And courts have supported that position and said, that's right, you can't just hold on to somebody because you think they may be here illegally. And where this comes from, Diane, is it's like, look, it's very basic. It's that you want to have the community be in a position where they trust the police. They pick up the phone and they call the police when they are the victim of a crime or when they've seen a crime. And what's been shown very clearly is that if you have these kinds of policies in place, people are afraid. They don't come forward. And ironically, it makes our communities less safe to have these policies in place.
Stephen, I gather you disagree with what cities and communities are doing. You do see it as a risk to public safety.
Of course, and so do most Americans. Look, the bottom line is what we're talking about is somebody gets arrested by the police. We're not talking about the police going out looking for someone. Someone's in a jail. They've been identified by the Immigration Service as an illegal immigrant, and they simply ask that jail to hold the person. Now, it's important to note 90% of sheriffs who run the county jails in the United States do cooperate with that, but a number in big cities that get a lot of attention don't, and that's why we have these numbers. According to DHS itself, in 2014 and 15, 17,000 people were released even after the Immigration Service asked that the jurisdiction hold them. Of those individuals, 63% had been convicted of a crime already, and one quarter went out and committed a new crime within a year of being released by the sanctuary jurisdictions.
So, Angela, what do you make of that?
Look, if somebody commits a crime, they should absolutely be arrested, convicted, and jailed. We're not excusing people for their their criminal behavior. But what we are saying is that you can't just hold on to somebody indefinitely, and the courts have agreed on this, once you have processed them and you've already sent the fingerprints to DHS. They have the opportunity to act on it if they have a warrant.
And that's the question. How long are these people being held, Stephen?
Yeah, typically it's only 24 hours or 48 hours. And many jurisdictions even have a policy when they're about to release one. Not only do they not cooperate with the detainer, that's the request. Remember, they do cooperate in the same circumstances with the Federal Marshal Service when they ask to hold someone, or even, say, a U.S. military when a jail is asked to hold someone who's AWOL, then they're going to come by and pick them up. In this case, they don't cooperate. And they even have policies in place in lots of cities that won't even tell DHS that the person is being released. That's what happened in the Kate Steinle case. Not only did they refuse to honor the detainer, but they never even told DHS that they were releasing this person who then went out and murdered someone.
And we'll talk more about the Kate Steinle case after we take a short break as we talk about what might be done during a Trump administration regarding those who are here illegally and who have committed crimes. I'll be looking forward to hearing your questions, comments. Join us on 800-433-8850.
DCS Daily.
DCS Daily.
DCS Daily.
It's news,
culture, and curiosities.
From the District, Tacoma Park,
Alexandria,
Friendship Heights,
Hyattsville,
Falls Church,
Northeast Washington, D.C., in your inbox every weekday afternoon.
DCS Daily.
Sign up at dcs.com/newsletter.
dcs.com/newsletter.
And welcome back. We're talking about what might the new policy about immigration and illegal immigrants here in this country who have committed crimes be under a new Trump administration. And Stephen, just before the break, you mentioned the name of Kate Steinle. She was a San Francisco woman and killed by an undocumented immigrant. Talk about that case.
Okay, so this was an individual who had a criminal record. He was in the custody of ICE. The city of San Francisco actually said, hey, we want to charge him with something else. We release him to us. They said, ICE gave it to San Francisco. And San Francisco subsequently decided not to charge him. Then they didn't tell DHS, and they released him. And shortly thereafter, he murdered Kate Steinle in San Francisco.
Ms. Huffer, do you want to comment?
Well, I think, you know, the Kate Steinle case has obviously brought a lot of focus on this practice. And, you know, I think there's debate on both sides of this issue. It was clear under San Francisco city policy that this person had not committed any violent felony in the last 7 years, which is what their guidance are, and they released him. Under their policy, they would respect the detainer if that had been issued as a judicial warrant, and that wasn't done either. So in the absence of both those situations, he was released. I think it does, frankly, raise issues that kind of one policy applying to all may not be the best situation even for these cities. Someone like the person who killed Kathy Steinle had a lot of record of past immigration violations, about 5 or 6. So he should have been, in my opinion, treated differently by the city, that just because he did not fit the city ordinance for holding. But given his history, that should have been evaluated, and they should have made an exception and allowed ICE to at least interview him. So I think you'll have, as a new round of these, you'll have a new round of these that these cities will sort of recalibrate their policies in light of the experiences that they're facing.
CNN, Angela, reported that Lopez Sanchez, the immigrant who was here, had been actually deported five times. And isn't that the concern?
I mean, absolutely. And this is where I think Musaffer was making a really smart point. I mean, all his points are, of course, smart. But it really is local officials, it's police chiefs themselves that know how to tailor policies to their communities. The fact that somebody has been deported several times, absolutely a problem. But that's ICE's failure. That's a failure of our federal immigration policies. That doesn't mean that we now want to have local police chasing after people, demanding papers of them, asking them to become immigration agents and evaluate whether those papers are true or not and what do they mean. I mean, that will make us less safe. And, you know, like, if you just look at the kinds of examples that many police chiefs and many local officials give, the police chief of Dayton, Ohio, for example, as they adopted policies that that built on community trust, that built on community policing, that realized that they have an immigrant community that they want to work with, they saw serious violent crime drop. And so if we want communities to be safe, which is the ultimate goal of our local police, then we need to leave it in their hands to know how to do that.
So Angela said he started refusing to cooperate with immigration officials years ago. Tell us what happened. Give us the history.
Well, this might be where Musaffer, the professor, could probably do a better job than I can. But yes, I mean, going back, actually back to even 1996, where there were a suite of immigration laws that were passed, including laws that said that you can't have a state or local policy that says that you can protect people and not give the information. It was Mayor Giuliani of New York City that actually sued on that and said, wait a minute, federal government, we don't want you telling us that that my state and local officials can be forced to share information that we don't want to share. Like, you fast forward now to 2016, right? All these years later, we now have states and localities where undocumented people can drive legally, where they have ID cards. In New York alone, there's 800,000 undocumented people that have ID cards. So the question is, are we going to now ask that all that information be turned over to the Trump administration? Is that the kind of society we can be? It's just, it's unimaginable what that would cause.
Musaffer, I gather this actually grew out of efforts by American churches back in the 1980s to shelter and protect people who were fleeing from civil war in El Salvador, Nicaragua, Guatemala, and then it grew.
Exactly. You know, the term sanctuary cities is basically a catch-all phrase to define a large array of phenomenon. So it kind of, the distinctions among these various actions get sort of lost in this broad definition. It started, at least in this country, from the movement of various churches in the 1980s who were thought they were going to provide sanctuary to people fleeing the violence and civil war in Central America who might be picked up for removal by the Immigration and Nationality Service, Nationalization Service at that point. At the same time, there was a parallel development in various cities which made it their policy to ask their officers not to inquire about the immigration status of people that they get in touch with. That was seen as a parallel development, not widespread, frankly, but this whole phenomenon about sanctuary city and the focus on sanctuary city got huge new rebirth after 9/11, and particularly after Secure Communities program was put in place, which entangled now these local jurisdictions in the pursuit of federal immigration enforcement in a way that never had been. I mean, just to put it in context, in 2014, I think about 75% of people removed from this country were all picked up as a result of Secure Communities program. And that, therefore, it sort of made without their intending to, these local jurisdictions as the front line of immigration enforcement, and that's why many of them had to rethink this role.
So now, Stephen Camerota, you have the president-elect and Republican lawmakers vowing to withhold federal funding from cities that do not cooperate with federal agents.
Yeah, and as I said, 90% do. It's only a small fraction in certain localities that don't. And let me be clear so we understand, they're not asking that they go out and arrest illegal immigrants. What they're saying is someone who gets arrested, we submit their fingerprints, we determine that they're illegal immigrants, we're just asking, the federal government is asking the jurisdiction to hold that person, or at the least, now remember, there are places like San Francisco and New York that won't even inform federal authorities that someone that the local jurisdiction has arrested, been identified as an illegal immigrant, they won't even let them know that that person is about to be released. Trump's position is essentially that if you don't think that illegal aliens who get arrested and are in jail should be deported, well, then really you're against any kind of immigration enforcement because that's the bare minimum. Someone who's in a jail and been arrested should be deported. If you think not, then what you're really saying is we really shouldn't have immigration enforcement. We should have, in effect, de facto open borders.
And what do you say to that?
Wow, I'm pretty stunned that we got all the way to open borders. I mean, look, the courts have ruled very clearly on this, that you can't hold someone on a detainer without a warrant. You have to have probable cause. So in the world that Steve wants us to live in, if ICE has a warrant for somebody, then they should execute that and they can get that person. Nobody is saying that we shouldn't enforce our immigration laws. Our immigration laws are really tough. It's very hard to come to this country legally, and it's hard to enter this country illegally because we actually have very effective enforcement at the border. The question is, what are we going to do with the 11 million people who are here as we go into an administration next year that seems hell-bent, frankly, on deporting them?
And joining us now by phone from Seattle, Washington, is Mayor Edward Murray. He recently signed an executive order affirming Seattle's policies that protect undocumented immigrants. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me on.
I know you signed an executive order last month affirming Seattle as a, quote, welcoming city. Tell us what this order does.
Well, maybe I could reframe who we're talking about as opposed to the speaker who claimed that we're having open borders. The morning after the election, I gave a press conference affirming our position as an open and welcoming city. I got calls from schools all around our city. I went out to an eighth grade classroom of high-achieving students, almost entirely Latino or Muslim. And as I talked to those children, I realized a good number of them were actually undocumented themselves. They're scared. They've lived here their whole lives. They don't know Mexico. They've never lived there. They came as toddlers. Their parents have taken jobs that no one else will take, and they are paying taxes. So if you frame it that way, what we are doing and what we are saying is you are not going to take our neighbors away. You are not going to take our children away. You know, cities have always depended on immigration to work, to get innovation, to get small businesses, to create a good economy. So, you know, the order comes down to basically that. You're here. We're going to offer you services. We have no intention of cooperating in your deportation.
Tell me how Seattle handles those federal requests to detain undocumented immigrants.
So the jail's actually under the control of the county, and to some extent that rests with the county. We're not interested in if we stop someone because they're undocumented, we stop someone on a traffic stop or the like, and they're undocumented, we're simply not going to cooperate. If it is a felony, that's a different situation.
Now, are you concerned about President-elect Trump's promise to withhold federal funding from cities that don't cooperate with federal agents?
We're absolutely concerned. The federal government gives cities like ours money for human services. It helps with transportation. But also remember, Seattle has about a $5 billion budget. About $85 million of that a year is federal money. The federal government has stepped back from their responsibility to be partners with cities for 35 years. The discussion we should be having is not about cutting cities, but about supporting cities, the federal government supporting us, because we are the revenue generators in this country. That's where the economy is happening.
So you're not going to worry if
as I said,
he does withhold?
Of course we're concerned. $85 million is no small number, but still out of a $5 billion budget, the federal government has consistently cut money for affordable housing. My city stepped up this last year and by a 70% vote doubled their own taxes to build affordable housing.
All right, and you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. So, Mayor Murray, I gather you do not call Seattle a sanctuary city. How come?
So, sanctuary city has this is a term that doesn't necessarily, there's no set of legal, it's a different interpretation jurisdiction to jurisdiction, and different jurisdictions have different responsibilities. And before I became mayor many years ago, when these ordinances were passed by the city council, they chose welcoming. We are an open and welcoming city.
Why do you feel so strongly about this?
Well, because, when I go into that school and I see those children who are scared and live in this city their whole lives, when I meet their parents who are working hard in our hotels or in our hospital industry, or when I think about my grandparents, all who immigrated from Ireland, it puts it in a very different perspective. And the other thing I would add here, a few months ago, I was with Bill Gates up in Vancouver, Washington, with the mayor of, Vancouver, British Columbia, with the mayor of Vancouver, British Columbia. They were opening up a Microsoft Center just north of our border for other people that cannot get into this country because of our crazy, crazy immigration laws. So this isn't about some people who are committing criminal activities. This is about tens of thousands of people who are either doing jobs at the low end or doing jobs at the high end that we have no consistent immigration policy.
How concerned are you about how President-elect Trump may change these policies?
Well, one hoped after the election that maybe he ran from the extreme right and would moderate himself. But after his most recent speech where he gave his victory lap speech, it was a frightening speech, something I expected out of a South American dictator, not from somebody who is about to become the most powerful man in the country. I am deeply, deeply concerned about this issue as well as civil liberties in general. I am actually not, on one level, I'm not surprised. On the other level, I am very surprised. Usually when people get elected, they step up and understand the Constitution and what they're elected to do. We're just not seeing that.
So what will you do if indeed there is the clampdown and the statement that the city of Seattle, Washington, will lose millions of dollars?
Well, we will challenge it in court. We will work with our incredible federal delegation, Senator Patty Murray and Senator Maria Cantwell, to fight it in Congress. And again, this is a city that five times in 2 years was willing to raise its own revenue for programs that we used to get money from the federal government for. I think if it is a choice between keeping our neighbors and our children in this city and or having to raise our own taxes, I think this city would choose the latter.
And you believe that Seattle residents will be willing to have their taxes raised in order to fight back on this issue?
It wouldn't be their first choice, but absolutely, I believe that they will. Absolutely.
Edward Murray, he's the mayor of Seattle, Washington. I want to thank you so much for joining us this morning.
Thank you for having me on. It's an honor.
Thank you. And we will take a short break here. When we come back, we'll get reaction to Mayor Murray's comments and take your calls as well. Stay with us. And welcome back. As we talk about immigration, what may happen under a new administration led by Donald Trump, Stephen Camerota, you heard Mayor Murray, the mayor of Seattle, Washington, speak very emotionally and strongly about why he believes Seattle will remain strong in protecting its citizens, illegal or otherwise. What is your reaction?
Well, most of what he said, of course, is irrelevant to the discussion we're having here. It's a fascinating question. What should we do about an amnesty? How do we, if we want to have a large fraction of illegal immigrants legalized? Now, obviously, the mayor is very concerned about the illegal immigrants, the Americans who face the job competition, or the Americans who have to send their kids to overcrowded schools because of illegal immigration. That doesn't seem to be his primary concern, but we could have that debate. But none of that is what we're talking about here. What we're talking about here is people who are arrested and in jails, and the Immigration Service says, would you hold this person? We've identified them as someone who's been previously deported, has a serious crime, has immigration violations, and the jurisdiction says that we will not hold them even for 10 hours. That's what we're talking about. We will not cooperate. We won't even tell you that someone in our jail who's an illegal immigrant, we're about to release them. Things are so bad that the Obama administration has put 10 jurisdictions on notice, and this is the Obama administration, which has kind of had a wink and a nod to this whole policy. These include New York, Chicago, the entire state of California, the city of Philadelphia, because they have gone so far as to not even have any communication with the Immigration Service. That's how bad. And they have threatened to cut off Department of Justice funding. This is a very new development in the last few weeks.
All right. I'm going to open the phones now. First to Pat in Orlando, Florida. You're on the air.
Thank you, Diane. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
My comment is just with regard to the statistics that were quoted. You know, I hear this a lot, and I've heard it today, that, you know, so many percentage, I think the statement today was 63% of people that were released had already been arrested previously, and then some percentage of them were arrested afterwards. I'm a retired judge. I spent a lot of time in the courtroom with a lot of people who were brought over from the jail or that were in jail, who were there as undocumented immigrants, and then their crime was driving without a license. Of course they're driving without a license. They can't get a license. And so when I hear statistics like that, and we're calling these criminals in jail, I think it's important that we distinguish between what types of crimes are we talking about. And I don't think it's a fair representation if we're saying 63% were convicted of driving without a license before, and now they're still driving without a license. And I guess I'd just like to hear the comments from your guests.
Stephen?
Well, I didn't count those. I counted those with criminal convictions, 63%. And as I said, 25% of that 17,000 people who were in our jails and purposefully released, 25% within less than a year had been rearrested for new crimes, including murder, rape, and robbery. Now, sure, some of it is just a third drunk driving conviction. It depends on how you feel about that. But the point here is twofold. One, it's a public safety issue. Immigrant communities are often the victims of these individuals. And there's no good evidence that reporting of crime declines when you have this kind of just common sense cooperation.
Muzaffar, do you want to comment?
Well, yeah, I mean, I think the judge has made the point, I think, extremely well, that these things get broad brushed, that every when you use the word criminal, it conjures up memories as though this is a murderer, this is a rapist. The only numbers I'm going to quote are the numbers that come from DHS. Is the last time DHS looked at it, there are about 1.9 million foreign-born people in this country who have criminal convictions. That's also a broad term, which makes them removable. And that includes people who are lawful permanent residents. That includes people who are here on entered on legal visas and are here on temporary stays. If you look just at the unauthorized part of that population, it's about 820,000. Of those, about 300,000 have been found guilty and convicted of a felony. So it's a much smaller number when you actually start making distinctions among the subsets of this population. And we should all be focused on that subset. We don't have in this country the resources enough to remove any number of people that President-elect Trump may think we have. In a world of limited resources, you have to draw priorities. And that's precisely what the attempt of any good, smart administration should be. If the 300,000 people are the ones that deserve to be removed first, we should have a targeted policy that gets us there, as against putting large number of people in a funnel of removal, which then doesn't allow us to go after the really most dangerous people.
Stephen.
Look, these are the individuals. The Obama administration has really pulled back from a lot of enforcement. But these are the individuals that the Obama DHS and Justice Department asked these jurisdictions to hold. People they had serious concerns about. People who committed violent crimes. And they're not even holding them. And it is a terrible idea for a local jurisdiction to substitute its judgment about how dangerous someone is over the Department of Homeland Security, which has access to all the information. Again, these are individuals who've been arrested, and it's not everyone. They're not asking them even to hold everyone. That's an interesting argument. We could talk about that. They asked to hold these 17,000 people who they do have the resources to deport, who are in our jails, and the jurisdiction said no, and we won't even tell you when we're releasing them.
Angela.
I mean, I think that Musafer has given us real clarity on how to break this down and what the population is. But I think what's really been most fascinating in this conversation is that you have a mayor of a major city in the United States, a city that's thriving, and he's made it really clear the way that he sees the immigrant population being very much a part of the city's population and what he believes is best for his city. And then a former judge who knows firsthand that we can just have broad sweeping policies that really undermine, in fact, making communities safer. So I feel like it's really the people who are on the ground and working in the community that I think should be the ones leading the policies, and that President-elect Trump is on a collision course with the state and local entities, from college presidents to mayors to police chiefs, and that's worrisome.
Let's go to Meredith in Fort Worth, Texas. You're on the air.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I had a question for the panel with a comment first. My comment is that I'm disturbed to find out that local jurisdictions may and can and do release committed criminals, as in they have been either caught in a commission of a crime or, you know, the due process of that, and that they are being released and we're not knowing about it. So my question to the panel is, what would be a reasonable time, because we know our government takes time to do its work properly, for a known criminal to be held so that the government can do its job properly?
Steve.
Well, I would point out, first off, that the government has a whole program. It's called the SCAP program that compensates for people being held. So if they ask you to hold and you have to hold that individual, they'll pay you for the days that that person is in your jail and prison. Most of the time, they come within 48 hours. There's very few cases where that doesn't happen. There might be a jurisdiction out in the middle of nowhere, and it takes a while to get out there. But in these big cities, the time frame is usually very short, and yet they still released 17,000 people after DHS asked them to hold them.
I wonder, Muzaffar, if you could talk about those 17,000 people.
Well, we don't know what the 17,000 people, how do we categorize them. But I think, again, to make the point that this is about local jurisdictions making judgments about the safety of their own cities and localities, that they look at the profile of the person, they say, what is the probability that the person is going to be a safety risk in our streets? On the basis of that judgment, they release that judgment. And I think most people would agree that the decision about what is safe and unsafe in the local jurisdiction is best made by the local police chiefs. And if they have made that decision, I think there's reason to believe that that should probably override the decision made by a general policy of Immigration and Customs Enforcement made without taking into account the level of danger that that person presents.
Steve.
Yeah, look, I mean, the bottom line is this is incredibly hypocritical. When states and localities were trying to help the federal government, like Arizona, these same groups like Angie and my other panelists were saying, look, immigration law should be entirely a federal function. Now what we have is the federal government is moving to enforce the law, and the same groups are arguing that the federal government can actually defy and undermine federal immigration law. It's really a kind of neo-Confederate-like argument for nullification, whereas Muzaffar said the local jurisdiction should be able to substitute its judgment for the DHS. Remember, we were talking, and all these statistics relate to the Obama DHS. And so it's been pretty weak on all of these issues, and yet the jurisdictions still are said to be able to define and have their own immigration policy in effect.
All right. Can I just add something? In Manhattan, New York.
Hi. You know, something that's been, you know, I think we need to make perfectly clear is that, you know, immigration and customs enforcement, you know, has issued detainers, you know, that this is simply the start of an investigation. And, you know, a lot of these sheriffs that have these policies nationwide, they're, you know, Republican sheriffs, you know, they don't want to hold somebody and then find out that they're a U.S. citizen and end up getting sued. You know, within a 4-year period, over 800 U.S. citizens were held on detainers. And, you know, I just want, you know, like, as Stephen has said over and over again, you know, like, this is somebody that ICE knows is in the country illegally, and many times that has proven to be patently false.
Angela?
Yeah, you can't tell looking at somebody whether they're undocumented or not. So that's exactly the problem, is that detainer requests are triggered when a person is arrested, even if that person has been never charged with a crime and was mistakenly arrested, or they have an old conviction for a minor offense. This is why courts have ruled you can't do this. What ICE can do is, if it has a warrant, it can issue a warrant. But in the absence of that, to have police just hold people because they think they might be here illegally, even when they haven't been, you know, charged with a crime, that puts us in a very precarious situation as a society.
Stephen?
No, I mean, look, there has been very few cases of that recently. And what the Immigration Service is asking is to be able to come and interview that person to make a quick determination. And these police, well, as I say, the vast majority of sheriffs do cooperate. It's only a small fraction that don't. 90% do, because they recognize the public safety element here. And what the Immigration Service is asking to do is come and interview that person to make a quick determination. And what these jurisdictions are saying is, we're going to substitute our judgment. And the vast majority, 99%, are people here illegally, 99.999%. The American citizens who've been held is a very tiny number, and it doesn't happen recently anymore.
And you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. Let's go to Louie in Orlando, Florida. You're on the air.
Hey, Diane, great discussion. I am a victim. Back in the 80s, when I was a lot younger, I got out of the Marine Corps, and my brother offered to take me out fishing on my dad's boat. We got boat jacked off an area called Stiltsville in Biscayne National Park. We managed to escape. We took gunfire, peppered our boat with bullets, and it was an illegal Bahamian, an illegal Colombian, and they were stealing boats. You remember Miami in the 80s was the cocaine cowboy era, and they would steal boats, go to the Bahamas, load up, and come back to try to steal ours. And we went to trial. They each got over 10 years in prison because they had robbed other boats. They had done a long string of robberies. And what I understood at the time is they did their over 10 years in jail, plus they were deported after that. I don't want cats like that in my freaking country. So how can people not want those kind of cats to be out? I don't get it. I want all the DACA wonderful kids that are super bright that came here as babies to stay. But when you say that those guys are staying and you fight so hard, these people on the show that are fighting to keep these violent criminals here, they won't admit there is these type of violent criminals that have to go.
Muzaffar, do you want to comment?
Well, I think that's an excellent point. That's exactly, no one should be able to defend a criminal like that. People who have that kind of history should be removed as quickly as we can. They should be the highest priority. I don't think anyone is arguing against that. It is that we must have the ability to make distinctions between one group of people with offenses and the other. Yep. And yeah. That's what the local jurisdictions are trying to do.
Angela.
Yeah, I completely agree. And I mean, look, the reality is that we've got a very complex, diverse society, that people who break the laws, who commit the kind of crimes that the caller had to endure, absolutely should be convicted, serve jail time, and be deported. There is nobody that is defending that kind of individual. But the caller also mentioned the DACA kids, which I think does go to show the complexity of the population, where you have 700,000 young people who have come forward. Their information is sitting in DHS. Their parents' information is sitting in DHS. And now with the advent of a Trump administration, they're terrified. And that's why you're seeing the kind of response from university presidents, from faith leaders, from mayors, from law enforcement that are saying, well, wait a minute. We can't go to either extreme, but really look at the population and make decisions about what we're going to do.
What are university presidents saying?
You know, it's pretty fascinating. There was a letter that was started from a small college in California, Pomona, and it was it's basically a sign-on letter of university presidents that has ballooned and is now, I think, pushing 500. It was 491 colleges and university presidents that signed it. And what they said is really, I think, pretty powerful. What the letter says, and I'll just read from it very, very briefly. To our country's leaders, we say that DACA should be upheld and continued and expanded. We're prepared to meet with you and present our case. This both a moral imperative and national necessity. America needs talent, and these students who have been raised and educated in the United States are already part of our national community. They represent what is best about America. And as scholars and leaders, they are essential to our future. So you have from the president of Princeton to the president of Prince George's Community College in Maryland signing on and saying, this is our future.
All right. We're going to leave it at that. Angela Kelly, she's with the Center for American Progress Action Fund. Stephen Camerata is director of research at the Center for Immigration Studies, and Muzaffar Chishti is director of the Migration Policy Institute's office at the New York University School of Law. Thank you all.
Thanks for having us.
And thanks all for listening. I'm Diane Rehm.
The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Baker, Denise Couture, Rebecca Kaufman, Lisa Dunn, Alexandra Boti, Danielle Knight, Erica R. Hendry, and Allison Brody. The engineer is Douglas Bell. Visit drshow.org for audio archives, transcripts, and podcasts. Our email address is drshow@wamu.org. And we're on Facebook and Twitter. This program comes to you from American University in Washington. This is NPR.